So do we have in us a little bit more stamina to survive one more?
Oh, yes. Keep it coming.
Okay, that was pretty enthusiastic. So I will accept that you spoke for everyone then, okay?
Listen, those that don't want to be here, they will leave. So it's not a charge of faith.
Was that home sustain? There's, I have not... 8 years ago or so, there was a book that came out by a physician, and I thought he had originally been at Harvard. They laughed him out of, I don't know if they finally took his right to practice out because of it, and he finally took it out of the book. It's about this thick on homocysteine because he wanted to get it out. And I don't know if he actually lost his license or not.
No, I would be...
And I've forgotten his name.
I would be very surprised if he lost his license because of it, because if you are talking 10 or 12 years ago, there was already a lot of research on homocysteine, and homocysteine already back then was considered a risk factor for heart disease, neurological or a risk factor in neurological conditions and a variety of other conditions. So.
I've had it for a long time, mm-hmm. but it was about this big.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to make this a little shorter. I don't know exactly how, but yes, I cannot exactly promise, but let's see. If I can be successful at least somewhat, okay? So this time we will be discussing diabetes. And I'm sure you know diabetes, when we discuss diabetes, diabetes is a disease in which we struggle with what? Blood glucose level, right? Blood glucose seem to be elevated, and in fact, blood glucose seem to be swinging oftentimes. So people who have diabetes, not only they have oftentimes elevated blood glucose level, but they also often develop hypoglycemia, which is a low blood glucose level, okay? And we have several types, and the most common type is called type 2 diabetes. You know, it is estimated that 90%+ of people who have diabetes have type 2 diabetes. That's the type of diabetes that is related to the way we live, or lifestyle related, okay? Although there are others. Notice that this disease is also among the most frequent causes of mortality or death. It is listed consistently on the 10 most frequent causes of mortality in this country, and it is actually rapidly increasing. This is the newest data in terms of how commonly spread it is. So when we look at this, notice 21 or over 21 million people in the U.S. have diabetes. And then additional almost 60 million or so have what we call prediabetes, which means their blood glucose level is elevated, although it is not elevated high enough to diagnose them with diabetes. Right? Yet notice 80% of premature heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes can be what?
Prevented.
Can be prevented, okay? Which means people don't have to develop this. And a bulk of diabetes prevention has to do with really one factor. Can you guess what it is? It has to do with weight status, okay? As people gain weight, they have a higher risk of developing diabetes. And depending on actually our ethnic background, we don't necessarily have to be obese to develop diabetes. We know, for example, that Asian people, even when they have body mass index in the normal category, but toward the upper scale, they may already have diabetes or may already develop diabetes, okay? So, you know, obviously, if we are obese, then the risk goes that much higher. But we don't have to be obese to develop it. what is the status quo? Meaning you go to the physician and you are told that you have diabetes or pre-diabetes, and what does this physician do? The physician, by guidelines, the guidelines are issued by the American Diabetes Association and the European equivalent of that organization. By guidelines, you are to be put on metformin. Okay, that's what it does. That's the status quo. So I want to, in that context, I want to show you, this is a study with almost 3,000 people, and these people were randomly assigned to either a lifestyle change, metformin, or control, which means they didn't do anything. No lifestyle change, no pill, nothing. Okay? And notice they were on one of these, or in one of these groups for 15 years. Now, what was the lifestyle change? What did they have to do? Well, this quote explains it. The lifestyle program included a 16-session curriculum with individual sessions aimed at achieving a 7% weight loss through a healthy, low-fat, low-calorie diet and 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity physical activity. I would like to suggest to you that they didn't have to do a lot. You know, the people who were put on the lifestyle change program, they didn't have to put a lot. Let's say they weighed 200 pounds. Okay? How much would be 7%? 14 pounds. That's not a lot of change that they have to do, you see? 150 minutes, I mean, that's nothing, you know, per week. If it was per day, maybe, but per week, not a lot that they have to do. These are the characteristics, the baseline or characteristic at the beginning of the study. So we have the placebo group, metformin group, and lifestyle group here. And I want to point out that they were matched very well. Matched meaning that these factors were virtually equal, virtually the same, meaning the age was the same and how many women in each group was the same, and so on and so on. All these factors were matched very well. Notice weight and body mass index was virtually the same in these groups, and the hemoglobin A1c, which is the long-term measure of blood glucose level, was virtually the same. Okay? Notice what happened here. This quote illustrates what happened. The cumulative incidence was 27% lower for the lifestyle group than for the placebo group, and 18% for the metformin group than for the placebo group. Let me explain what this quote is referring to. Okay? So these were people who had elevated blood glucose level to begin with, but they did not have diabetes yet. Okay? And they were assigned either to lifestyle intervention, metformin, or control. Okay? And over a 15-year period of time, they monitored how many of these people developed type 2 diabetes. And they came up with this quote that explains how many. The quote saying that those in the lifestyle group were what? 27% lower than those in the control, and those in the metformin group 18% lower. Which leads me to a question. Which of these groups was the better off? Or which was the most effective? The lifestyle intervention was most effective, right? Than the metformin. And so the metformin is a specific type of medication that is prescribed to regulate blood glucose level. Okay? So what the status quo should be? The status quo should be that people should be told to change their lifestyle, right, rather than they should be in a place on a drug. But unfortunately, we live in a little bit different world than the ideal world that we would like to see. Okay? Notice the quote or the conclusion: lifestyle intervention is more effective than metformin in reducing risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Okay? Remember this study I was just talking to you about this study earlier, the EPIC Potsdam study from Germany. And we look at these risk factors for cardiovascular disease or heart attack and stroke. Well, here is the data for diabetes compared with participants with no healthy factors. Those with all four healthy factors had reduction of how much?
93%.
Imagine? 93% reduction. So only a few of those who practice these healthy lifestyle factors develop diabetes in comparison to those who didn't. Okay?
It can be related to like a genetic factor?
Well, I don't believe so, because the analysis is based on whether they practice the factors or not factors. Factors that did not include genetics, but rather whether they smoked, what they ate, whether they were physically active, you see? So genetics here didn't play any role whatsoever in these results, okay? And we read this conclusion that lifestyle is very effective in terms of preventing of morbidity. So let's look at diet and diabetes prevention. And I do not have time to go into all the details of the dietary, you know, factors. So let me just summarize here that there are dietary factors that increase risk of developing type 2 diabetes and factors that decrease the risk. And in the first category, the factors that increase the risk, they include meat intake, eggs intake, white rice intake, and refined carbohydrate intake. And that translates to sweetened beverages mainly, and or sweetened foods like candies, for example, and chocolates and things of that nature, you know? On the other hand, when it comes to decreased risk, we have fruits intake decreases the risk. Vegetables intake decreases. Whole grains intake decreases the risk. Legumes and beans and or beans, nuts decrease the risk, okay? So that's the summary. And again, I don't have time to elaborate on all of it, but I will elaborate on some of these factors, okay? Just to support what I just concluded with some studies. So here is meat intake and risk of diabetes. And this is data based on two studies. You can see here, Prospect EPIC study and Morgan EPIC study. And notice what we have here. We have groups of people based on average intake of animal protein, okay?
That's per day?
Yes, that's per day, okay? So from group with the lowest intake, higher, and the highest intake here. And this, or these numbers, illustrate the risk of developing diabetes, type 2 diabetes. What do we see? What we see is that as the intake of animal protein increases, so does the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, okay? So it's not just meat, because this is what? Protein of animal origin, so it can be anything, including meat, any product of animal origin that contains meat increases the risk based on this. In fact, they also evaluated the impact per 10 grams per day. Now, 10 grams, that's 1/3 of an ounce. That's very little, very small amount. And they noticed that each 10 grams or 1/3 of an ounce of animal protein intake increases the risk by 32% of developing type 2 diabetes. Okay? On the other hand, notice here we have intake of plant protein. And again, from the smallest amount, higher, and here we have in between here. And what do we find? We have these numbers don't go in the linear direction like they do here. If anything, we have point something, right? Lower than one means what? Protective. Foods of plant origin that are high in protein actually protect from developing type 2 diabetes. That's what this data shows us. Okay? Here we have another study. This is meta-analysis based on several studies for 100 grams per day of red meat intake, 100 grams. Last night I told you how much that is in ounces. Do you remember? 3.5 ounces, okay? 3.5 ounces. So for every 3.5 ounces of red meat intake, in this study, there was a 19% higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Okay? And here we have for 50 grams per day of processed meat, that's about 2.5 ounces, a little bit more than 2.5 ounces, there was a 51% increased risk of type 2 diabetes. So there are study after study, we can go regardless of which study, and we can see that meat intake increases risk of developing type 2 diabetes. That's what the studies are showing us. Egg intake, okay? And again, here we have data based on several studies, 22 independent studies. And what do they show? Comparison of highest category, which means one or more eggs per day of egg consumption, with lowest, which means less than one egg per week or never, resulted in a pooled hazard ratio equal 1.42. That means 42% higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Okay? And so again, we have study after study after study that shows, here's another one, that egg consumption increases the risk of type 2 diabetes, which would be consistent with what I showed you earlier, that protein of animal origin increases the risk, right? Notice this particular quote. For each 4-week increment in egg intake, the relative risk of diabetes was 1.29, which means 29% higher in comparison to if we didn't have these 4 eggs per week. Okay?
That confuses me, because so often, you know, in doing these different diets, it's always, well, have an egg. And if you just have one egg and, what, dry toast or something like that, mm-hmm. you think that you're...
Meal.
Yeah.
That you are doing yourself a favor, right? Did you have a
healthy meal, right? At least that's what I'd be thinking.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So because that is my meal that I run to when I don't have anything else. I keep boiled eggs in my refrigerator.
Uh-huh.
So if I want a boiled egg and a piece of quick toast, I think I'm doing myself justice.
Right. Well, and that's why we verify oftentimes our assumptions and our customs with what nutritional science is showing us, you know. This morning I shared with everyone that I grew up on everything that moves, you know. I used to eat pork and I used to eat other animals. Mm-hmm. And then I saw in the Bible that certain meats were not permitted.
Right.
And then I became, or made even one more step further and quit eating meat altogether, you know, and stuff. So, you know, I look at the issue of dietary intake as one of the issues of my faith, related to my faith. And I try to always improve on what I eat and what I don't eat, so I can take the best care of the body, which is the temple of the Holy Spirit, the Bible says, you know. And so again, we have assumptions and customs and maybe stuff that we grew up with, maybe stuff that our parents practice that seemed right, and then they are verified. And we may be shocked, but that's good. The shock therapy is oftentimes good for us, right?
Yeah.
Because we learn better ways and we can find alternatives and we look for alternatives and we grow, you know. And maybe in the process we meet new friends that perhaps cook a little bit differently and gives us alternatives that we have never thought of earlier. But not only they may be easy to make, tasty and healthy. You know, praise God for that, right?
Yeah.
You know, so. Yeah. Pastor, did you have something?
You know, actually, I remember a doctor talking about diabetes, and this person was saying, well, if you have diabetes type 2 or you are in that direction, you should eat a diet high in protein. You want to avoid eating certain carbohydrates, and they classify some blends of carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. And we are presenting here the pancreas.
Yes. And the unfortunate truth is that scientific discoveries, before they are implemented in clinical practice, it's not years, it's decades oftentimes. You know, it's decades. And so the so-called carbohydrate counting practice has been around for many decades. And even though we know from scientific research that this is not the best way to maintain your blood glucose level, but that's what's being still practiced. You know? So sometimes it takes not only learning from scientific research what works the best, but also breaking some habits and what we are accustomed as clinicians, that you know something else may actually be working better. So. All right, let's look a bit further. Let's look at fruit, because that's another thing. Carbohydrate counting oftentimes boils down to what? Counting how much fruit we can have or how many fruits we can have. In fact, diabetes patients are told that they have to count how many grapes they can eat and things of that nature. You know, so I want to show you what nutrition science says about this one. Okay, see, notice this is data based on three different studies. Okay, Nurses Health Study, Nurses Health Study 2, and Health Professionals Follow-up Study, with a lot of people included. And what we find here is this number one and this straight line here that corresponds with number one indicates the risk of developing diabetes among those with the lowest intake of specific types of foods, fruits. Okay? And then these bars that we have here represents the risk among those with the highest intake of specific type of fruits. Okay? And what do we find? We find that with the exception of cantaloupe, in case of cantaloupe, there was a slightly increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes among those with the highest intake of cantaloupe in comparison to those with the lowest intake of cantaloupe. But for all the other fruits, all of them, those with the higher intake of fruits had a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Okay? And in fact, let me read this to you. This illustrates the magnitude. Okay? For every 3 servings per week, the pooled hazard ratios of risk for type 2 diabetes was 0.74 for blueberries. That means 26% lower risk among those who ingested 3 servings of blueberries per week in comparison to those who did not ingest any blueberries. Okay? 26% lower risk. 0.88, that means 12% lower risk for grapes and raisins. 0.97, which means 7% lower risk for apples and pears. 0.95, which means 5% lower for bananas and for grapefruit as well. So virtually all of these fruits were actually what? Beneficial rather than being detrimental. Okay? I have another study that there is a variety of other studies that show basically the same thing. But in this study, they actually recruited newly diagnosed people. So these people were not pre-diabetic. These people already were diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. 63 of them, notice. And they put them into 2 groups based on how much fruits they ingested. High fruit group and low fruit group. And notice what happened. This is a measure of hemoglobin A1C, which is the long-term way of assessing blood glucose level. And notice that those with a high fruit consumption had a better improvement in hemoglobin A1C than those with a low fruit consumption. So what we know from nutritional science is that fruits not only help in preventing diabetes to develop, but when you develop diabetes, when you ingest fruits, they actually help in blood glucose control. So the question is, why would we want patients who have diabetes to reduce fruit intake? Why would we want them to count the number of grapes that they can eat when we find this beneficial impact? You know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, it does not make any sense. Now, my students actually get this because I introduce them to these studies, but I don't guarantee that other students in other programs actually learn about this. They may be still learning that they have to reduce the intake of fruit. You know, the patients with diabetes. I don't know, but that's likely what they are told. Notice, this is not just me, that my interpretation. This is a quote from the authors who published this research. We recommend that intake of fruit should not be restricted in patients with type 2 diabetes. Okay? Now, I want to turn to something different, a different aspect, because when we look at diabetes or patients with diabetes, we also have to look at their comorbidities or complications, because people who have diabetes, they develop kidney problems and vision problems and neurological problems and a variety of other health issues. They have higher risk for cardiovascular disease, for example, and so on. Okay? So when we recommend something for them to implement, or if we take away something from what they may be practicing, we also need to consider these complications, right? So, number one, let me introduce you to some of these complications. Notice here we are talking about stroke, right? They have a higher rates for stroke and for heart disease death, right? Further, they may have diabetic retinopathy. You know what I'm talking about? Have you ever seen a person in town, even indoor, who wear glasses, dark glasses, but not only they have the glass in front of them, but here on the side, you know? Because in diabetes, you actually develop what? Issues related to the eye, and any light that comes in, whether from the front or from the side, is going to bother you, type of thing, you know? And so this is just an illustration of what could happen. Kidney failure, notice, diabetes is the leading cause of kidney failure, accounting for 44% of all new cases, okay? And here's another data for kidney failure. Neuropathy, so some of the neurological issues, tingling and feeling pins and needles and, you know, not feeling the stimuli and things of that nature. That's what they experience, you know? And lower limb amputations, notice. And I remember this one instance where a friend of mine asked me if I would be willing to go and see her friend's husband and talk to him. And I said, sure. Now, she explained to me that this fellow had type 2 diabetes, and, you know, he had already complications, and she wanted me to come because, number one, I was a nutritionist, and number two, I was a male. So maybe what I say would play a role, you know, in you know, what he does and what he doesn't do. So I didn't see my friend for about 2 months. And 2 months later, when I saw her, I asked her, do you still want me to go and see your friend? And she says to me, oh, don't bother. I said, why? What happened? You know what happened? This fellow was 44 years old. And within these 2 months since I saw her, he had one of his limbs amputated. You know? He had 440 pounds. He was very heavy. He almost didn't move, didn't really go outside of the house. And that's the type of condition he got himself into. You know? But I remember another fellow when I was doing my internship, and I don't remember how or his weight, but he was number one, very tall and grossly overweight. And he had a complication related to wound healing. I mean, his lower legs, not here, but his lower legs, like this huge, you know. And he was coming every other day to the hospital to change, you know, the bandage and things of that nature, because it just looked terrible, you know, the open wounds and things of that nature. So this can develop very early in our life, especially if we don't take good care, you know, of ourselves, you know. So what's the status quo when it comes to complications? Well, the status quo is this. You went to your physician, say, 2 or 3 years ago, and you were told you have prediabetes and you were put on metformin. And now we are 2 or 3 years later, and the physician checks your blood glucose level, and he or she says to you, look, this metformin is not good enough any longer. You're going to have to take insulin. So you're going to have to inject yourself with insulin. That's what is being done, you know? I want to show you something interesting, that something that is actually, honestly, shocking when you think of it. Notice, insulin and risk of diabetic retinopathy in patients with type 2 diabetes, okay? Meta-analysis based on 7 studies, and you have the specific of these studies listed. And this is the conclusion what they came up with. People with diabetes who were actually on insulin therapy had 2.3 times higher risk of developing diabetic retinopathy in comparison to those who did not receive insulin therapy. Okay? Notice the conclusion that these authors made. The results of this meta-analysis provide a more complete and systematic picture of the role of insulin use in the development of diabetic retinopathy risk. Meanwhile, our results are statistically robust and yield important conclusions. And you know what these important conclusions for me are? Very simple. We can do something about diabetes. We read earlier, 80% of diabetes don't even have to develop. A change in a lifestyle can result in a complete reversal of diabetes. We don't have to rely on insulin. Then causes or increases the risk of us losing our sight or have, you know, eye complications and stuff of that nature. Okay? So what can be done about these complications? Okay, how we can eat, or what can we do so we actually decrease the risk of developing complications? So here is one thing we can do. This is a Japanese study, and they look at fruit intake and the incidence of diabetic retinopathy. Okay, they included almost 1,000 people who had hemoglobin A1C at or above 6.5%, which meant they had diabetes. That's basically what this number means. And notice what they found. They found that as the intake of fruit increases, illustrated here by these numbers, this is grams per day, so this is less than 1 ounce. This is slightly less than 3 ounces. Okay? This is roughly 8 ounces of fruit intake. As the intake of fruit increases, the risk of developing diabetic retinopathy does what? Decrease. Okay? Which means we should ingest fruits because, number one, they prevent from developing diabetes. They are helpful in keeping blood glucose in check. And further, what do? They actually also help in reducing risk for developing complications. You know? Let's look.
It's amazing because I have heard just the opposite. I have heard people say that they had taken their parents to have their diabetes check, and my daddy ate an orange and an apple and something else before he went, and his glucose was just sky high.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's saying that if we have the fruit intake, it's going to help us instead of hurting.
Exactly. Yes. And I'm not saying that you may not have an initial increase in blood glucose level. I'm not saying that. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying what the data is showing us, when we take a long-term picture of blood glucose management, the fruit intake will actually improve blood glucose management rather than be detrimental. That's what the research is saying to us. Yes. You know? And notice further, not only retinopathy, but this study looks at, notice, carotid atherosclerosis. Carotid artery is one of those arteries that goes into our brain. Okay? And what we find here, I will not go maybe into the details, but I'll tell you this, that those with the highest intake of fruits had, or fewer of these people had atherosclerosis, and the atherosclerosis that was present among these people was not as severe as it was among those people who had whose intake was low. Okay? So that means that fruits are also what? Helpful in preventing this type of complication of diabetes, which is atherosclerosis. That's basically what this is saying, and I will not go into all the details. On the other hand, let's look at another dietary item, meat intake. Okay? So notice this is a study, effect of cooked meat meal on serum creatinine and estimated glomerular filtration rate in diabetes-related kidney disease. Okay? So these, the creatinine and the glomerular filtration rate, that's basically a measure of how well our kidneys are functioning. Okay? And what did they find? Consumption of a standardized cooked meat meal resulted in significant fall in estimated glomerular filtration rate in all stages of chronic kidney disease studied. What they are saying here is that if you add a piece of meat into your meal, it's going to negatively affect your kidney function. That's what this quote is saying here. Okay? It's going to negatively impact the way your kidneys are functioning.
Okay? Protein.
Meat. Okay? It's likely the protein in the meat, but they didn't investigate what exactly in the meat here. They just investigated what adding a meat into a meal would do in terms of the way the kidneys are functioning here. Okay? Here we have another study, and in this study, they evaluated the impact of nuts and also the impact of olive oil, okay? And so we have here a few groups, and they looked at a variety of different complications, so retinopathy, nephropathy, and so on. And again, I will not go into the details, but I will tell you that the diet that included some nuts and virgin olive oil, the same virgin olive oil we discussed last night, was the winner among these groups, okay? Was the best in terms of reducing risk of developing certain diabetes complications. And so, just like we talked last night about the olive oil being the beneficial for cardiovascular disease, olive oil is beneficial for preventing diabetes complication also. And so are nuts also. But the olive oil was the most effective in this particular study. Okay? And so if we, you know, if we bake or fry or use raw oil, switching to extra virgin olive oil would be the thing to do, even though it is a little bit more expensive than some of the other oils in
grocery stores. That is the new crave on coconut oil.
So remember I mentioned that from time to time there are these waves of, you know, new best healthiest product out there. I think the coconut oil it belongs to that category. Okay. And I wonder, because I when I, you know, see a new phenomenon, I like to go to the medical literature or nutritional literature and see what support is there for this. And I wonder what these manufacturers of these products like this coconut oil know that us nutritionists do not, because there's nothing that supports what they claim in the literature. You see what I'm saying here? Okay? And so they make claims that are unsubstantiated in the literature. Now, if they are helpful, and I'm not saying they are not necessary, I'm just saying the claims are not supported. Now, maybe down the road, maybe in 2 years, maybe in 5 years, there will be some studies that will confirm these claims. But to make a marketing claim that this will prevent from Alzheimer's disease or from this and this, there is no support for that whatsoever.
Coconut oil
can handle a higher degree of heat.
Yes, that's one of the the arguments. In fact,
olive oil has a flavor to it where coconut oil is more bland and it will affect the taste of your food.
And that's
the olive oil is not heat tolerant.
Yes, that's one of those arguments.
It changes the structure of the heat.
That's one of the arguments that is used. One of my books is called Healthy Diet Without Secrets. And in that book, I have a chapter called Fats and Oils. And in the chapter, I deal with this issue. And I actually have a table in which I included the temperature, smoke and burning temperature of different types of oils. So I have in there a variety of different oils, including virgin olive oil. And guess what? It is just simply not true. If anything, virgin olive oil is actually more heat resistant than some of the other, not all, but some of the other oils. But that's a myth that has been around since before the war. I'm referring to World War II, you know? Even though already back in the 1930s, I think it was the American Chemistry Association, it was called, I think, back then, did a study in which they evaluated the burning point and the smoke temperature of these oils. And they showed that this was a myth. But this myth has been adopted and has been circulating as a fact for a very, very long period of time. So the take-home message is this. If you fry, if you bake, or whatever you do, you can replace whatever oils you have been using with virgin olive oil without worrying about, you know, changing chemical structure or burning or anything of that nature. In fact, I bake my own bread and I do things like stir-fried, and I only use virgin olive oil, you know. And I do it based on the studies that I reviewed and what's in the literature, rather than, you know, regardless of how long a given myth has been around. Yes, sir?
Well, what the problem is with a lot of these products that consider themselves virgin olive oils, they're not virgin olive oil. That they did a survey on olive oils, and about half of them were
counterfeit.
They were like Cristofo or canola oil mixed in with a little bit of olive oil. There's only like 10 companies that manufactured the olive oil that was actually pure olive oil. So you have to be careful on the olive oil.
I wish we were all Italians or Spanish, you know, because, you know, they have this ability. In fact, Middle Eastern people as well, they have this ability to taste it, and they know exactly the quality and things of that nature. I don't recognize the quality of the oil that way, you know. But, you know, these people are able to do that, you know. But I tell you what. If this is true, and I don't know whether it is or not, but if this is true, I may feel a little cheated on how much I paid for it, but even if it's 50% virgin olive oil, the advantage of having virgin olive oil versus some other type of oil is really worth it, you know? And again, in this chapter that I mentioned about fats and oil, I have a subheading, olive oil, and I elaborated on the health effects of olive oil, and there's actually a number of health effects. Here's just one example, but there are a number of health advantages of ingesting olive oil. So even if there are some olive oils that are adulterated, it still may be worth it in terms of health advantages. That's my take on it. All right, let's look at these complications. So, number one, not rather complications, but the role of vitamin B12 in managing diabetes complications. That's my specialty, so I want to also elaborate just a little bit on that one. Number one, metformin increases risk of vitamin B12 deficiency and hyperhomocysteinemia. Now we are done with the previous lecture, so you know what I'm talking about, right? Hyperhomocysteinemia. So if you are prescribed metformin, okay, chances are...
So what's that big old long word you just said again?
Hyperhomocysteinemia.
Okay, what is it again?
Okay, so let me translate this word for you, okay? Notice hyper, just like you have a hyper child, right? That indicates elevated or higher than normal, okay? Emia always refers to blood, okay? So this word means higher than normal homocysteine concentration in the blood, okay? Homocysteine is a compound that is derived in the body. The body makes it for a variety of reasons, okay? That's what that means. But when this compound is elevated, which is what this word means, okay, it is detrimental. It's actually neurotoxic, for example, and it causes cardiovascular disease, as we described earlier in my lecture, and has some other complications. In fact, there's a lot of complications from really pregnancy until centenarian, and everyone would be impacted detrimentally when this compound is elevated. Okay. So, number one, metformin, again, decreases absorption of B12. Therefore, people who are placed on metformin, who are prescribed metformin, are at risk of deficiency. You know, it's really interesting how things sometimes turn out. Last year, in 2016, I have written a manuscript in which I reviewed studies on metformin, B12, and homocysteine and diabetes complications, and I submitted that manuscript for a publication in a journal. And, you know, the editors submitted or sent my paper to reviewers. The reviewers reviewed my paper, and the reviewers rejected my paper. And when I read the feedback from the reviewers, they didn't like the fact that I stated in the paper that people who are prescribed metformin should be routinely checked for vitamin B12, because if you use metformin, you are at risk for developing B12 deficiency. So they didn't like it, they rejected it. Now, believe it or not, what happened was, let's see, this is Saturday, was it Monday, I think? I think it was on Monday, when the American Diabetes Association, or was it last week sometimes, regardless, within a few days, or a few days ago, the American Diabetes Association issued new standards of diabetes care. And you know what they stated in these new standards for the first time? They stated metformin therapy causes vitamin B12 deficiency, therefore patients receiving metformin should be routinely checked for vitamin B12 supplements. They just rejected my paper because that's what I suggested, you know? And now it's found in the official standards of care by the American Diabetes Association. But, you know, interestingly, they stated that's what clinicians are to do, but they didn't state it exactly how they are supposed to be checked, which tests they are supposed to use, how to interpret the results. So right now I am in the middle of writing in details what exactly needs to be done with these patients, you know? So, but isn't that interesting, you know? And so, but the take-home message is this. Anyone who is on metformin should be checked for B12 deficiency because they have a higher risk of developing one, okay? Notice we conclude that metformin treatment is significantly associated with an increase in incidence of vitamin B12 deficiency and reduced serum vitamin B12 level, okay? Now, why is this an issue? Because B12 deficiency increases homocysteine level, remember? And increased homocysteine and low B12 increase the risk for a variety of diabetes complications. And so here we have one example. Notice that multiple logistic regression analysis also show that variables that independently affected diabetes retinopathy risk were diabetes duration, hemoglobin A1C, and what? Homocysteine concentration. Okay? Further, we have here some exact analysis. you know, what level of homocysteine we need to check, which I will not elaborate more. Notice here is another complication, macular edema. That's another condition of our eye. And what this quote is saying, that again, homocysteine increases the risk of developing this particular eye complication in diabetes patients. Okay? And here we have diabetic nephropathy, which has to do with kidney function. And so elevated homocysteine increases the risk for that as well. And again, I will not go into the details, but that's what it means. Okay? And now I'm going to show you a very interesting study. This is an Iranian study. And I hope to very soon to actually either repeat this study or do a very similar study that they did back in Iran. Notice, vitamin B12 therapy more effective in neuropathy treatment than a drug therapy. So what they did was they included 50 diabetic patients. Okay, they put one of them, or they injected one of them with 2,000 microgram of vitamin B12 twice weekly for 3 month period of time. Okay, so this was not using supplements, but this was injecting them with B12 injection. The other group received specific type of drug. And notice what happened. This is how symptoms changed. Symptoms of diabetic neuropathy changed. So in green we have the changes for those that receive vitamin B12 therapy. And what do we find? Much bigger improvement in comparison to those who receive a drug. In pain, in tingling, and paresthesia, that means feeling pins and needles. Okay? In all of these, we have much more pronounced improvements among those that receive vitamin B12 treatment than among those who receive a drug treatment. And so, again, it shows the importance of keeping vitamin B12 in a normal level. Notice vitamin B12 is more effective than this particular drug for the treatment of symptomatic, painful, diabetic neuropathy. Okay? And that's what I wanted to share with you this afternoon. That number one, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, is lifestyle related. And we can do a lot about preventing it. And we can do a lot in terms of managing it or even reversing it when we are diagnosed. And also that there is something we can do in terms of delaying or preventing complications. And I wanted to share with you also, you know, this connection with vitamin B12. That's because it is simply my area. Okay? So if you have any questions at this point of time, I'll be happy to answer those questions.
Doctor, I'm interested. What made you decide that your area of study needed to be B12 and how it affected us in so many different ways?
Well, a good question. And you can take it as sort of an accident or God, whichever you prefer. Let me elaborate. I was participating at one of a large church meetings. It was in Florida, and you know there were a lot of people in there, and I talked with variety of people, and I talked with some people who were in similar profession, meaning they did something related to nutrition and diet. And one of them was an editor of a journal. It was not a professional or scientific journal, but it was a journal that focused on health. It was distributed to anyone who was interested in reading about health. And this particular person asked me if I would be willing to write a paper on vitamin B12. And at the time, vitamin B12 was not my area of expertise. I knew a little bit about vitamin B12. I was already working at the university, teaching classes and stuff like that. But I certainly did not consider it my area. But you know, he asked me, and I said, yeah, sure. Even though my next question was, or my question was, how much time do I have? You know, because even if I write on something that is, that I'm extremely familiar with, it still takes a lot of time to write, you know, because you have to document everything with references and stuff like that, you know. So he told me a week. And when I've heard a week, I'm like, oh, that sort of changes the story a little bit, but I, you know, I didn't change my answer. But I dropped everything I was doing, and I spent hours and hours and hours every day reading and crafting the manuscript. And when I was done, I was convinced that my old convictions about vitamin B12 were incorrect. So this opportunity to write this paper made me realize that I had certain assumptions about this nutrient that were actually myths in light of the newest research on this issue. And then I realized that in my church, and I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, and in my church, we have a lot of people that potentially may end up with vitamin B12 deficiency because we focus on health, and we have a lot of vegetarians and vegans. Okay, and even though vegetarian and vegan diet can reduce risk of a number of health conditions, but if you end up with nutritional deficiency such as B12, it may actually reverse these advantages, you know. So I realized that in my church, there is no expert on vitamin B12. And in fact, physicians and people who lecture on, who are considered gurus in vegetarianism, have the same myths, believes in the same myth, and they spread the same myths that I believed in. And so I was still teaching classes and was sort of doing sort of minimum to get, you know, good evaluation and, you know, and have students see, look at me like I sort of knew what I was doing in the classes. But I spent not weeks and not months, but years since studying this. In fact, I remember one year, a few years ago, I was on my spring break. I went to Turkey, on a vacation. And I was with a group of people. And we would stop in this one place and we would go and see whatever site there was to see. And then we would come back to the bus and we were waiting until everyone came back. And then we went to another site and saw another site. And I came to the bus a bit earlier than some of the other people. And from my backpack, I took a paper, one of the papers. I printed several papers on vitamin B12 and I was reading it. And then there was another faculty from a different university on the tour. And she saw that I was reading a scientific paper, and she made this comment, oh, working on vitamin on your spring break, you know, that I was working on my spring break. But I was already so fascinated about this nutrient, and I saw so many things that were obvious in the literature, but people were unaware of, you know, that I got so into it that, you know, that I tell you it was really something. And you know, of course, the rest is history. I published my papers in very prestigious scientific journals on this, and people send me all the time stuff about, you know, scientists from all over. The last one was from Switzerland, sent me questions about some of the content of my papers because she's writing like a position paper in French for Swiss audience on this particular nutrient. But I get this from all over, you know. So now I get this satisfaction that this time that, you know, you may think by accident, you know, I was asked to write this. I think God asked, you know, God led me to this person who asked me, and now I can teach others. And you know, in addition to the scientists I mentioned, I had a lecture a few years back in Poland, in Polish. And this lecture was recorded. It was on vitamin B12. It was called Truth and Myths about Vitamin B12. They recorded the lecture. They put the lecture on YouTube. It's in Polish. If you would be interested, you know, in heaven, we all will be speaking Polish. So if you listen, you will know what Polish sound like at least, you know, even though you may not understand what it says. No, it's not Spanish. It's Polish. No, it's not Spanish. It's and you know what happened? They recorded it and posted on this blog for people, anyone, who, because it's free, available for anyone. But they posted it on YouTube. There is now more than 200,000 views. Now we are talking Polish and very specific topic. And yet, a lot of people viewed that. And since then, I started helping out with a blog where people, Polish people in Polish, ask questions. And you have no idea how many people I was able to help in terms of answering the questions. We are talking from very young children where mothers write, you know, completely desperate because the child has extremely severe conditions and they don't know what to do with, you know. To women who lost their babies while they were pregnant. And I got this email once from a vegan, a person who described himself as a vegan. And he told me he adopted a vegan diet for, forget now, whatever period of time. And he said to me this in an email. He said, I felt progressively worse, but I ignored it. And then one day, one morning, he woke up and he couldn't get up. His neurological damage was so severe he couldn't get up. And then he said that now if I force myself to make 100 feet, 100 steps, I'm going to suffer for the next two or three days. That's what he described to me, you know. So, you know, I got the opportunity to help so many people, you know. And I could give you stories after stories after stories. And so I tend to think it was God more than a chance, you know, that I got into that. And I'm so glad it has such a practical implication for a number of people, a variety of people, you know. So, yeah, I give you an elaborated answer, but I hope you don't mind that.
Yeah, that's good. Because I think God sent me here today.
A couple of things. I've had diabetes now for about 13 years. I've been on 1,000 milligrams of metformin twice a day, and something else. And you know, I'll see my sugar levels jump up. They never go real low. I never had a problem with dipping. They're always go up, and then they're just a little high. Then they go up, and they're just a little high. And it's real frustrating because everything. I mean, my insurance company sent me to a seminar, 16-hour seminar over a period of weeks at a hospital, to teach me how to count my carbs, read the labels, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's like, and for a long time I didn't eat fruit at all. Now I'm back eating fruit because I enjoy it. But I don't drink juice, but I do eat fruit.
Yes.
But, you know, and I don't do sugary drinks, I never have. And there's just some things that just are frustrating. And yet, when they tried to put me on insulin, I said, no, I'm not going on insulin. Well, just give me time and I'll get my numbers back down. So my A1C was like 9.2. And I said, I'll come back down. But stress triggers body.
Yes.
Terrible. And things outside of myself, I feel like 3 years I've been under a lot of stress. I lost my son. A year later, I lost my husband. You know, this past fall, I was engaged to be married to him. I was selling my house. I was closing down a 2,900 square foot house. You know, unloading all that stuff, getting rid of my late husband's stuff, and moving to South Carolina. My numbers were sky high again. Got it back down. You know, it just seems like no matter if anything changes in my life, it just seems to go up and down. And it drives me up the tree.
Yes. And honestly, that's actually pretty common also. People who have some type of traumatic event in their lives, a surgery, for example, completely unrelated surgery, and they are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes very shortly after. So that's unfortunately how the body works. I mentioned earlier, you know, when we go through life, you know, commit stuff to the Lord, stuff that we have no control over. And, you know, he said, why do you worry? you cannot add an inch to your height, or you cannot, you know, make your hair this color, whatever color, right? So there's stuff we cannot have any control over unless we learn how to cope with these type of situations. It will just go on and go and so on, and eventually type 2 diabetes may actually become type 1 diabetes, because to all these stresses, the pancreas is reacting by secreting insulin and then secreting glucagon, and there is actually even other hormones that are being secreted from other organs in the body, and eventually they got enough. You know, eventually they just give out and got enough, and you may lose completely the ability of secretion of these hormones, and then you will have to be dependent on insulin. So we have to learn how to control some of these external stimuli, you know. And I tend to do that. I mentioned this earlier. I just pray, and, you know, we all have these type of situations. And I just take God, take care of it, you know. And I can sleep through the night, you know. I can, no problem, really. And so we have to learn how to do that, you know. Now, one way to help in terms of blood glucose, you know, jumpings and so on, is dietary fiber is extremely important in blood glucose management, you know. And in fact, dietary fiber, if we ingest adequate amounts of dietary fiber on everything that we eat, it can actually maintain blood glucose level in the normal range without the need for insulin or metformin or anything, and without the jumping. And
they explained to me that if I had 5 grams of dietary fiber, mm-hmm. In any item, if I read the label, I get to deduct that 5 grams for the number of grams of carbs. Mm-hmm. And that would keep, you know, again, it was all carb related, and count the numbers. So mm-hmm. I had a lot more fiber.
Yes.
Now that we're married, I'm not eating as much fiber in my meals as I was before.
Uh-huh. Honestly, my suggestion would be to forget those carbs, you know. Now, remember, let me scroll back for a second. I'm going to show you one more time. This is it, okay? Notice white rice contains carbohydrates, okay? Refined carbohydrates that we mentioned, sweetened beverages, candies, things of that nature, right? That stuff you need to be mindful of. Okay? And you mentioned you don't really have those in your diet, right? Well, that is not a lot.
I do candy, but I don't do drinks.
Uh-huh. On the other hand, notice foods that decrease the risk include foods that are very good sources of carbohydrates. In reality, with really the exception of nuts, all of these contain carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. And when you look at things like whole grains and legumes, they contain a lot of carbohydrates, but they are in the same time very good source of fiber. So it is not carbohydrate that is the problem. The problem is where these carbohydrates come from. You see? So if you have white rice, that may be problematic, but if you have brown rice, you should enjoy it. I cannot elaborate on everything, but I can show you results of specific study in which they showed brown rice decreasing the risk, white rice increasing the risk. You know?
And that, again, I do, now I said not relocating and readjusting, I've not gotten the brown rice, but normally I do the brown rice. And, we're doing a little bit more eggs than I was doing before. But, I mean, you know, there's some mm-hmm. adjustment. Another thing that I just discovered, which again drives me up the tree, I checked my blood sugar level about 30 minutes after I ran over 2 miles.
Yes.
I'm building up. And it was sky high. And I'm like, what is this? I'm exercising. They tell you to exercise. And my blood sugar was sky high. So I Googled it. And they said, yes, that happens. Your blood sugar goes up when you exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But it eventually comes back down. I'm like, well, how long does it take for it to come back down? And when you're, like the gentleman said earlier, when you're exercising and when you're doing it on some pretty regular basis,
mm-hmm. yes.
Like, what do you do? You
but,
tell you to exercise, but then it throws your blood sugar up?
It's very similar to what I mentioned with the fruits, okay? I am not saying here, just like I think, Mom, you mentioned that someone, you know, was eating, you know, say an orange or whatever, and the blood glucose went up. I am not saying that when we ingest the fruit, the blood glucose will not initially go up. But what we know is that if we look long term, we actually see that the intake of fruit is actually beneficial. And the same goes for physical activity. You will see a jump in blood glucose level. You could, unfortunately, you could also see, fortunately you say that's not your case, but theoretically you could also see a drop. That's why for anyone who has diabetes, the recommendation is for when you engage in physical activity, you should have some type of a quick source of glucose in case you have hypoglycemia. But you may see elevated blood glucose level. But in the long term, that physical activity will help you to utilize the glucose better and to help you in blood glucose control. So the initial thing that you may check and you will see, it's not as big of a concern, or it doesn't outweigh the long-term benefit of physical activity. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it just seems like everything I do makes my sugar levels go up.
Yeah, and honestly, I wouldn't even worry about, you know, these short-term measurements, you know? If you are put on a relatively hard, healthy diet with plenty of fiber, get rid of the refined products and quick sources of sugar, you know, and, you know, go more plant-based, you know, have some activity, overall it should be, you know, should have pretty good outcome. And in fact, you know, for people who are willing, there is plenty of evidence that showed that if you switch to a vegan diet, you can get rid, you can reverse diabetes altogether, you know. But that means cut down completely 100% on meat and animal products, you know, and not everyone is willing to adopt that. But for those who are, you can completely get rid of the diabetes.
When you're talking about doing that, there are two kinds of fiber.
Mm-hmm.
That brings it down to both types, or is one better than the other?
So functionally, there are two types of fiber, and the truth is we don't have to worry which type. Why? Because practically speaking, in any given food that naturally contains fiber, we will find both. Okay? So you have, it's the physiological effect in terms of managing blood glucose level is attributed to the water-soluble type of fiber, okay, or viscous fiber, it's called. Okay, and so the predominant sources would be stuff like oats and barley, for example. There's some fruits also. But practically speaking, anything that contains naturally fiber, which are foods of plant origin, contains both types of fiber. You know?
Because when you buy it, I was told to use some fiber, but I didn't think it was the water soluble. I thought it was the other for bulk.
I think we need to focus on food that naturally contains fiber rather than fiber supplements. You know, yeah. If you have to, for whatever reason, take a fiber supplement, Metamucil would be a good source, and including for people with diabetes, because the bulk of what is in Metamucil is psyllium fiber, which is water soluble.
Well, this is instead of a Metamucil, it is a.
But it, preferably,
that's what it is. It's psyllium, mm-hmm. But it's just not the.
Yes, but preferably we need to focus on foods that are high in fiber. An example: you buy a loaf of bread in a grocery store, and it's a white bread, and it says, when you look at fiber, it will say less than 1 gram per slice. On the other hand, you buy whole grain option, and it will say 3 grams, 4 grams, or 5 grams. So there's a huge difference in between these products, you know. You have about half a cup of beans, they will have somewhere between 6 to 8 grams of fiber. You have an avocado, even small Hass avocado, will have about 8 grams of fiber. So there's plenty of fiber in foods, when we don't refine them, when we actually eat foods rather than, you know, what manufacturers oftentimes do with the foods. You know what I'm saying? So, I want to show you at the end, I want to show you some resources that I have. We will not be selling anything right now, but I have written a few books. If any of you will be interested, I can give you my email, and you are welcome to contact me and request this. Number one is In Defense of Vegetarianism. Number two is Vegan Vegetarian Mother and Her Baby. And as far as I know, this is the only book that deals with this particular population. So if you have maybe children or grandchildren who may be vegetarian or vegan, maybe a good one. Healthy Diet Without Secrets, that's the one that has this chapter on fats, among other things. Here's another one, Forever Young, Secrets of Delaying Aging and Living Disease-Free. And that deals with nutrition as we age, you know, this particular book. And then this is my newest one, Vitamin B12, Combating the Epidemic of Deficiency. I actually don't have a picture of the cover, but I also have two biblical books. Well, one is out of print right now, so I may not mention this one, but another one I just published, a biblical book, is called Resurrection versus Life After Death. Okay? It's a biblical perspective on what's the nature of Christian hope. Is it waiting for Jesus to come and the day of resurrection? Or is something that lives part of a human being after we die? That's what that book is about. So if you would be interested, let me know. And I mentioned I give you here. I give you my email.
Are any of your books on Amazon?
Only in electronic version? Yeah, they are. Another way that you can order. Oh, I see. This is my email address, if you would be. Can you see this? Romucha. That's the way my dad called me when I was a kid. You know, so yes. I want to thank you, number one, for inviting me, Pastor, and all of you for coming. And I hope you learned something. And as I mentioned a few times throughout, if you invite me back, I'll be glad to come. I'm only about 4.5 hours or so from here, and I'm gonna leave the house a bit earlier just to account for potential construction or other things. So. So I won't be late.